shit.
I wish I was 50 years younger and I'd kick your ass.
But fans can be the harshest critics, you know.
And they often are.
A wife is often the harshest critic of her husband.
I thought I was invincible. That's what you're trained to believe as a sports person.
There was 4 million people in Ireland who knew much more about managing football teams than I did. When it comes to music, I can spoof it the best.
Your sporting career is the best time you'll have. And, you know, you have to hang on to it for as long as your life, because everything else is pretty crappy.
And this is not light. Stephen Rothschild has never spoken to Jim McGuinness in his life.
So the former Waterford hurling manager, Derek McGrath, is alongside me in studio. How are you?
How are you, Nathan?
You've teamed up with Electric Ireland and Pieta House to encourage people to experience the power of hope by registering for this year's Darkness Into Light event. It takes place on the 11th of May. You can check it out on darknessintolight.ie or use the hashtag thepowerofhope or DIL2019. Darkness Into Light, as always, organised by Pieta House and is proudly supported by Electric Ireland since 2013. I'd say you didn't need too much convincing to get involved.
No, absolutely not. Probably the worriest of all causes. I'm a teacher by trade, I suppose, when I'm in there, the last 20 years. And you see guys even between 12 and 18 now presenting with mental health difficulties, common mental disorders, if you like, and locus parentis that goes with teaching, duty of care that you have to students, yeah. We're looking out for them. And I think that's translated into teams now. I think most managers are going the compassionate route as well in terms of their approach, compassionate and ruthless at times. You can mix both, if you like, but... Yeah, delighted to be involved. From a managerial point of view, we had our own situation with Maurice Shannon, a much publicised situation in my first year. At the time, selfishly, I felt I could solve it myself, help Maurice out. Not a qualified counsellor, but emotional intelligence might lend you to think that you can solve everything, but realise that the assistance and the expertise of Pieta House is very, very valuable, you know.
I'm not sure how much you can talk about Maurice's personal situation at the time, but from what you can tell us and how that developed from you as a manager's point of view, you need to say, thinking, I can sort this.
Yeah.
What are your memories of it?
When you think of the learnings, Nathan, I'd actually be horrified to say that definitely was not overly selfish. When Maurice presented with difficulties to me initially, he was talking about how he was feeling, if you like, and, you know, there was an incident, and... selfishly, I would have said, Maurice, you'll be grand, you'll be fine, you'll get through it. We'll help you, blah, blah, blah. I actually remember almost, and it's wrong to say it, but I remember taking a video. We were playing Cork in the Championship that May in 2014, the day Austin Gleeson made his Championship debut. And I remember going down and Maurice clearly in a bad place and getting a phone and saying, Maurice, look, do a video for the lads, will you? Wishing them well. You know, ahead of the match, might get some motivation. So the selfishness of me to put him in a situation, he was in a precarious situation,
yeah.
And yet here's me kind of thinking. So I think, look... What were you thinking?
This will make him feel part of the group?
I was thinking that, to be fair. I wasn't completely self-centred in terms of what I might get out of the group. I was also thinking, I was thinking selfishly. I was thinking motivation for the players, let's do it for Maurice type approach. And I was thinking, well, it might be a way back in for him as well, an avenue back in for him. So, but... the reality is you need expertise and you need help in that area, you know, but it's an interesting topic, but not a time I'd be proud of, you know.
Yeah, it's such a difficult position for a coach to be in, because quite often, I think you've mentioned this before, people will talk to coaches before they talk to anyone else, and you're somebody away from the family and the intense close friendship network where maybe people feel difficult to open up. Like, did you... When you started to realise the problems that Maurice was going through and just how severe those issues were, like, did you see yourself as a potential saviour here? Or?
I probably did, you know. I probably always backed myself on the teaching element of the altruistic element of the vocation that is teaching, coming out through your interaction with players, and you kind of say to yourself, you can solve this. But the reality is you haven't the absolute expertise needed, if you like, you know. And I do believe in the one good adult theory that, you know, where people purport to the fact that, you know, a coach's influence or a manager's influence on a person or on a player can be nearly greater than a parent, or, and they can confide more in that. There's, you know, that's proven. And I've read a brilliant dissertation on the whole idea of mental health literacy by Clean O'Leary, actually. And it points out to the fact that, you know, it points out methods and methodologies of trying to spot common mental disorders in players or in, you know, anyone growing up between, you know, at a young age. You know, it's an interesting read.
And obviously you're teaching young kids, as you mentioned, so you're looking after young adults from 12 up to when you were coaching, all the way up to probably 34, 35. What sort of issues are you seeing at the moment in school?
Yeah, in school, I think they're worrying a lot. You know, I was at my son's junior infants open night in October, and the principal there just said there was guys as young as 8 or 9 presenting with mental health difficulties. So I think they're just worrying, they're thinking. And I think the balance between... well, I'll give you just a perfect example. I went to school between 89 and 94 in De La Salle, the school where I'm teaching in. And if you came home and you were given out by the teacher, you wouldn't even tell your parents, because the parents would completely back the teacher. Yeah. Not based on not loving you or being conditionally devoted to their sons, etc., or unconditionally. Nowadays, I think there's more of an atmosphere around the whole area of kind of worry, and they're thinking more. You know, even from the point of view of sport, I think, you know, guys that are... And the path seems to be the traditional path that some people may have taken in terms of leaving school and going on to an apprenticeship has been definitely replaced, I would say, 85-95% by college. You know, even from a sporting point of view, I would see it as, in sporting terms, it would be, you know, under 14 hurling, 15 hurling, junior hurling, senior hurling, freshers, Fitzgibbon, inter-county, and at the same path, the educational path is nearly as ambitious. So fellas are kind of thinking more, they're worrying more, and I think they're a little bit more intellectually curious, for want of a better phrase. You know, they're kind of asking more questions, and with those questions, they want more answers. So getting the balance and getting it politically correct is nearly impossible as a teacher or as a mentor. But it's and then you're trying to, sometimes tough love or harsh logic is the best way with them as well. And how do you get the balance there in terms of your approach in class or in management? I think there's no cut and dry. There's no answer really to that. I think what you have to be is, you have to know your team or your students well enough to be absolutely coercive where necessary, or to be absolutely affiliative, you know, where necessary. But it's hard to outsource that. Like, it's hard to be completely empathetic all the time, you know. And I think there's times like I would have given out to a student in class, and you go home that night and it doesn't cost you a thought, like, you know. And then if you're at home all night over worrying about a student you admonished or you kind of got onto in some way, you're not going to live a proper life either. So you're going to got to get the balance right, you know. But it's very hard.
I would imagine so, particularly when you talk about getting to know your kids or getting to know the squad, but particularly in a school, I think it's children coming into first year, young boys, and all the worries and stresses and strains that they have. Mm. It takes a long time for a teacher to get to know their personality, yet those first few months are so important.
Yeah, and look, in most schools now, they have induction policies when the students come in. They have a mentoring program, they have a buddy system, if you like, in our own school. The transitioners, you know, look after the students. Everything is kind of being done to facilitate their whole well-being and their integration into the classroom situation. I think, I won't say the old school, because I better be careful, or the old school attitude in terms of, you know, don't smile till Christmas, that sometimes you would have heard on the HDIP in education when you were training to be a teacher, you know, or I didn't hear it, but it was kind of, you know, it became part of the folklore almost, you know, that I think that's gone. I think there's a more, not sympathetic, empathetic approach to teaching and learning, and everything has been facilitated so that there's people that, you know, like, we have mixed ability years in first and second year, you know, people are not concentrating as much on the whole element of higher level and ordinary level, you know, and there's not that academic kind of snobbery that exists sometimes. And it's the same as a dressing room, I suppose. You have that wholesome environment where you have a guy coming in from his shift work, you have a guy coming in from medical studies, you have a guy coming in from teaching, you have a guy coming in from the farm. And it's trying to integrate that into a happy environment in a classroom. It's probably the same as a team environment, you know?
And not treat them all the same.
Without a doubt, you can't treat them all the same. I'd be strong on that. Even down to school rules, to rules within a team environment, or
even down to school rules. Because I know we're comparing a lot between teenagers and a senior inter-county squad. Like, senior inter-county squad, they've bought into this. They're building towards a bigger thing. Mm. Seems a little bit easier to explain. There's one rule for one person, one rule for another, than it is to a 13-year-old.
Yeah. Well, look. Take a simple rule or issue in any school. It might surround mobile phones, or it might surround anything. They're banned or they're not banned, etc. And or a guy that's late some days for every day for school. You might look at a situation where pastorally is everything all right at home, that he's late. Why is he late? And then does it come to a situation where you have to kind of say, you have to take action on him being late. And then a guy who's never late arrives in. Late. You're not going to deal with him in the manner that you deal with the guy that's, you know, late every day, if you like. You know, there might be just a one-off. And I think you have to have the the intelligence to be able to kind of read it, common sense, if you like, to be able to read the situation as it is in front of you, depending on the situation. Now, there are times in classroom situations where, of course, you'll have to go with the generic approach. You won't be able to individualise everything in a 40-minute class with 26 students. You won't be able to individualise at all. But I think if you like your job and you're loving your job, you should be able to find a way of doing that, you know.
How often do you go home satisfied with your day's work?
Every day.
Yeah?
Every day. Every day, but you're always looking to try and get better in teaching. You know what, look, I took well-publicised parental leave while I was doing the Waterford job.
Full-time hurling manager.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, completely obsessive about it. When I'm teaching and I like it, you know. When I was doing the hurling and the teaching, I found it difficult to do both, so I just did the hurling, you know. So I learned from that as well.
And are you obsessive about the teaching side of it as well?
Well, I would be fairly disgruntled if my results weren't good in my class. You know, like anyone, I have a bit of pride in it. You know, I'm not a brilliant teacher. I'm not an unbelievable teacher, but I'm a hard-working teacher, I suppose. I'd like to think, says me, and I've taken a personal day for today. I've taken a personal day today, and with the permission of Miss Betts, the principal. But yeah, I'm harsh on myself, I suppose, in terms of just trying to get better at it, but I've lots to improve on, you know.
Yeah, you mentioned there that the kids today are intellectually curious. I know you've described yourself as as a child has been intellectually curious. That it was always why, how, what.
Yeah.
Are they intellectually curious in a different way than they were when you were growing up?
Yeah, I don't think there is. I think they move on a bit quicker than I would have probably moved on. You know, I think they move when they ask the question and they get the answer, they seem to be more satisfied than I was with the answer. You know, not that I was a difficult student, right? But I think they're inclined to move on. And, you know, even my own, I've two boys now, 5 and 13, have one in first year in De La Salle. And you're just, you can see similar traits and he's kind of asking questions, but they're inclined not to dwell on the answer as much. They just kind of move on. If that's the answer, that's the answer. Whereas I was more inclined to kind of look for another answer, you know.
Yeah. When you were in management, how good were you at getting out of your own head? How good were you at sharing the load when the pressure was on?
Not brilliant. I used to kind of follow a definite process of grieving kind of first, you know, after a bad result. Or, you know, follow a process of feeling it first, because it was so... When you're in a county like that hasn't won an All-Ireland since 1959 and you're just wanted so much, it does envelop you and it does kind of consume you to the point where it does affect you, I suppose, you know? And I think that's natural. And I think I remember reading Bill Walsh's book, The Score Takes Care of Itself, and there was one point he said at one of his standard of performance, he says about abnormal levels of concentration and focus should be part of your makeup, you know? So when I read that, I was kind of saying, well, Jesus, that's okay.
It's all right to be obsessive.
Yeah, I was kind of saying it's okay. At the time when I was managing, I've only just recently read that book, someone recommended it to me, and I was reading it, and I was saying, Jesus, it's okay, I was actually like that. So maybe I should have been tuned into the fact that this is okay to be like this, you know? So I learned from that.
Why, would you be feeling guilty about the level of obsessiveness?
I would, in terms of a family point of view, in terms of the mood of the house. You know, the mood of the house would be completely dictated by how the league game or the championship game went naturally, because when you're surrounded by it and it's everywhere in terms of local radio, local newspapers, etc., local people, and people I've met, you know, the majority of people I've met in Waterford are genuinely sincere and genuinely, you know, helpful and very, very nice towards our whole approach of Waterford over the 5 years. So it's not that. It was more my own kind of thinking, wanting it so much to the point where it becomes where you can't, you know, not that you're hamstrung, but that you're kind of saying, we want it so much. Even, I would say, even the relationship with the players, which is always good and was good and still is good, to the point where they were nearly saying, we'd love to do it, you know, with Derek involved, you know, without sounding self-absorbed or self-centred, you know. So, you know, that kind of, I'd learn from all those situations, definitely, if I was to have another go.
Yeah. So when you got home on a Sunday night after a tough defeat, do you lock yourself in a room watching TV by yourself? Do you sit and chat to your wife and go through, should I have done this, could I have done this?
We'd have a kind of, you know, not a certain amount of pretense, if you like, because we would have said... We say in the final year when things weren't going well, we're kind of saying, look, no matter what happens this year, we're just going to go with it now and we come home and live a normal life, blah, 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 you know, that kind of thing. But it was all really pretense, I suppose, more than anything else. So you'd watch the normal Sunday evening programmes, you know, whatever dramas on Sunday night. But look, you're completely absorbed. You're there, but you're not technically, you're there in body, but you're not really there in mind. So, yeah, Monday I would normally start the whole process of ringing guys and seeing where seeing clarity as regards what went wrong in terms of the video analysis and
how you could write. Would it just be the people in the inner circle?
Inner circle, and I'd often, inner circle and a couple of key players then. And I wouldn't be ringing them for the point of view of this went wrong, that went wrong, or, you know, and I wouldn't be ringing them for reassurance or you know, to make sure consent almost. I'd be just ringing them having made up my mind as to what we did wrong, and we just move on. You have no choice, particularly with the nature of the championship this year and last year. You have no choice but to kind of move on, you know.
How different were you then in terms of handling that pressure from year one to the final year? When did you realise actually there is that obsessiveness? Do you think you were a very different person by the end of the journey as you were at the start?
Yeah, well, I was extremely sensitive at the start of it, I have to be honest. Completely not, I won't say hypersensitive, I'd say, at the start of it, in terms of the honour of being appointed a manager in your own county is huge, you know. And I would have said that I surrounded myself with really good people in the first year and in the other years, and I was almost kind of leaving them lead it. So I was putting no stamp on it myself. The end of year one, we had a major cull of the panel, 11 or 12 guys gone. And then we had three consecutive All-Ireland semi-finals, we'd say two consecutive league finals, two Munster finals and an All-Ireland final, winning only one of the five, you know. Mm. Winning only one of the five finals. So the growth was made easier in terms of personality or in terms of the levels that I was doing by being up and around the top echelons, okay? Then when you had the fall-off last year, you had the injury situation, you had the underperformance, you had the Welsh Park situation. So there was a certain, I suppose, comfort zone that you could almost put yourself into and say, well, we have the injuries excuse, we have the Welsh Park excuse, but the reality is we're not right either. So there's a blame that you have to put on yourself as much as the blame associated with Welsh Park or injuries, etc. So to answer your question in terms of the path that I take and on personal development, hypersensitive in first year, but still sensitive in fourth year or fifth year, because you have to be, because it means something to you. So, you know, if something is written that's inaccurate or untrue or unfair, you're not biting at it or anything like that. You're just going to go along with it, but you're kind of, you do feel an element of that, of course. I think that's natural.
And were you reading it? Were you going out buying a couple of papers on the morning?
No, I wouldn't read it, but I had a number of friends that would actually, you know, I just remember, not a funny story, but the night before the All-Ireland final, against Galway, we were in Johnstown House, and I allowed myself to watch a bit of Up for the Match, and I was watching a bit of it, and I thought it was a great fella because I was being praised from top to toe on this Up for the Match, and I said to myself, Jesus, Micheál O'Donoghue is not watching this now, he's in the zone like somewhere, and I said it. So I kind of slipped even from then that night. I was just thinking back on it, so I went to I was going to bed then, the lads were all, we were a couple of the backroom team watching it, and I went to bed then anyway, and I got this text from a friend of mine in Tyrone saying, Jesus, did you see what Babs wrote about you today, Babs Keating, you know? And I said, obviously didn't, you know? So sometimes, and then he sent me a picture of it saying, if Waterford don't win, Derek McGrath should be sacked. And this was the heading on the Sun newspaper on the Saturday before the All-Ireland. And sometimes I often, even on Saturdays before a big championship match, I go for a walk and someone would ring me or someone would text me and say, hey, listen, don't turn on local, don't turn on local radio, like, or don't turn on this, and they sure they might as well tell you what they're saying. So it's not a case of I didn't read them, but I, you know, they must have underestimated my ability to read a situation, because if someone rings you and says, you know, did you see, or don't turn on, you know, or someone texts you saying, you know, you're inclined to kind of go, oh my God, there's a bit in that, you know.
Yeah, it's incredible. I think it's one of the most common things that sports people and managers say when they come in here, that they don't read, but their friends give them a sort of general gist. And they rarely ring you to tell you that somebody's praising you.
Yeah, 100%.
If they think for some reason that it's going to give you that spark of, we've improved the point.
Even down to the point where I would have gotten, you know, people that genuinely mean well sending me articles that people might have written, you know, before a match and say, God, shove it down this fella's throat. But I think the idea of being motivated by what someone else has said, you might get a little spark out of that every now and again. But I think the long-termism of constantly standing up in the dressing room and saying, did you hear what this fella said about us? Did you hear what that? I don't think that's evident really in any dressing rooms now at the moment. You know, maybe every now and again.
Did you ever put a cutting from a newspaper up in a dressing room wall?
No, I never put a cutting, but I often would have referenced things that would have been said that were, that I felt maybe perhaps were particularly kind of scathing or particularly inaccurate or reflection of, like I remember reading something about the group being just very, very ordinary with three good players, and they named Austin, they named somebody else, and I kind of dwelled on the ordinariness of it, and I thought the ordinariness was a kind of a compliment, you know, that we were kind of the sum of the parts and the group meant more than anything else, you know. And so there would have been times like that, but sometimes indignation and anger channeled in the right way can be, you know, extremely motivating too, you know.
Yeah, that sensitivity that you spoke about in that first year, and you obviously took the job, you were well deserving of getting the job, there was obviously a confidence there in yourself that you could do the job. Did that come as a surprise to you, that sensitivity?
Yeah, and I'm not sure where it came from, you know, because I only had a kind of a very fleeting playing career at senior inter-county level. I played 20 years with the club, but I played 3 years minor and 3 years under 21. I played for 3 or 4 years with the seniors, only getting 2 championship appearances. So sometimes I think the insecurity that goes with not being that ex-brilliant player, if you like, maybe that feeds itself into a certain sensitivity as well. So I'd often look at that, but then I'd be saying to myself, we won 07 and 08, we won the colleges all Ireland, it wasn't won an award for ever. And I won the club championship with my club as well. So it was well kind of documented and well kind of signposted. So the confidence started to grow. But if I'm completely honest, the confidence probably only grew totally into the role in 2015 when we just took off and we won the league, and everything just seemed to take off after that with a newness of approach, if you like, in terms of the dynamic of the panel. A lot of young guys and guys ousted or omitted from the panel that perhaps just we needed a certain direction, you know, and I felt that was necessary.
So many of your former players speak so highly of you and how much they enjoyed the journey. We might talk about the journey side of it in a minute. For you, though, when you knew so many of them for such a long time, how did you sort of marry the developing young players, which I think are very keen in developing personalities and well-rounded individuals? How did you marry that with having to be a ruthless inter-county coach in a setup that's becoming more and more professional?
Yeah, with difficulty, but again, it comes down to the people that are involved, the players that are involved. And, you know, I think from the outside perspective, I'd say people probably see me as this affable, likeable character that lacks a ruthless, not lacks a ruthless streak, but mightn't be as forceful as perhaps is needed at times with my approach. But I would have been very, very forceful at times in my approach, even with the younger players, but I would have married the whole idea of what I call reciprocated guilt kind of laden approach, where you absolutely go out of your way to make things possible for a player, and you know that you've almost put him in an environment cunningly that he's going to give you everything he has, okay? And you know, I would have gone to extra miles for that for players, but there's also areas where you would have been completely straight with players. And I think it's just looking at the situation as it is in front of you. And I think it's preempting things as well. I remember last year, even we played Offaly in Tullamore before the Munster Championship started, about 6 weeks, and we actually spoke as a group about the 4 Championship matches. Because we were going to be honing in on the Clare game, the first game, we felt we may need to talk about it. And I remember just saying to the guys, look guys, if we beat Clare, what if we lose to Clare? And giving them all the scenarios of winning or losing about 6 weeks in advance, so that it's been dropped in there to kind of present the notion of it may happen, because the reality of sport. So that's why the last game against Cork, when it was a dead rubber game last year, when there was nothing at stake, I was very proud of the absolute totality of effort, despite missing 7 or 8 key players on the actual day. So to answer your question in terms of marrying and being ruthless and ensuring that there's a caring environment, it's there's only so much a player will take of complete affiliative approach, complete, you know, arm around the shoulder approach. Before long, they'll be looking, we're not getting enough criticism, we're not getting enough feedback. So it's, for me, it's a constant, not test or exam, to be ahead of them in terms of how they're thinking. You know, I take Conor Gleeson. When Conor Gleeson arrived into our panel in the first year, he was all over the place in terms of just, I would call him scattered. A brilliant young lad, a lovely young lad, but lacking a bit of focus in the first year when he came in. And then you know, at the start of the second year, we'd say, look, Conor, you have it all. You need to focus in. And then second year of focusing came on as a sub, or 2016 came on, played the All-Ireland semi-final, and 2017 then just grew into leader. Now he'd be running the show in the dressing room, you know. So you see that natural step up of a guy that goes from being scattered, if you like, and I mean that with the greatest sense of compliment to Conor, just scattered, and then growing into this kind of ruthless man marker and leader of the team, verbal or vocal in the dressing room. And you just see the growth in front of you. And I think sometimes the person I would have spoke to the least in the 5 years in the dressing room situation, in a hurling sense, would actually be Tadhg Na Buaire. And people would probably say, he's probably the guy that got most instruction. But there's some guys, you look at him, they don't even need huge instruction.
Yeah.
And they don't even need huge compliments afterwards. They don't need any, you know, they don't need any guidance, really.
And is that all intuition? Like, where did you learn all this? So, you, even down to 6 weeks out from the four Munster Championship games, some coaches might look at it and say, I don't want them overthinking this. We'll just concentrate on the chair game, and we'll do our work behind the scenes, but our message to the players is, we'll take game one and the momentum will bring us through from there. To actually sit down and plot out how you wanted the 4 weeks to go. And then also, is it just purely intuition? Is it studying other coaches?
There's studying other sports. There's the rugby element of it, I'd imagine, when the rugby guys go to camp in Carton House 4 weeks before the Six Nations, they're going to plan for. They're not just going to arrive on the Tuesday with a game plan for the England game.
And did you look into the rugby team?
No, I didn't. But I would have read it. Like I would have, and I would have known the format for what they're doing and the model for what they're doing. Because I think people are beginning to see that instinct can be married with planning, or you know, can be married with planning and in hurling in terms of, and passion can coexist, if you like, passion and instinct and passion, instinct and planning. So if I bear that out in terms of even our approach against in the four games last year, and give you the actual practical examples of that, we were going to go about it a particular way against Clare. Seven at the back, Tadhg is a sweeper, if you like, against Clare. We felt that was our best approach. We were 1-6 to 4 points up. Tadhg went off, broke his shoulder. We lost the game. We changed our approach for the Tipperary game, having mentioned that about a month before that, and having said, this is the way we're going to go against Tip. Now, the general perception in media circles was that God, Waterford left the shackles off against Tip. They played a different, completely different way. But it was actually, without being self-indulgent, it was actually planned that we would play that particular way. The biggest mistake we made is that the following week against Limerick, because there was so much praise, Waterford didn't play with seven at the back, which we actually did against Tip, but people didn't see it. We stuck with that for the Limerick game and abandoned the original plan for the Limerick game.
Right.
So I would give myself a kind of 2 out of 10 for my approach to the Limerick game last year.
And when did you decide that?
Decided on the it was Monday or Tuesday after the game. I was saying we can hurt Limerick. Almost kind of just talked myself into it stupidly. I said we can hurt Limerick with a certain shape. We call it an Offaly shape. We'd say where the corner forward comes out about 40, 50 yards from the goal, brings his man with him, leaves two inside. Centre-back sits back and centre-forward goes out into the middle of the field. Looks conventional to some eyes, but it's not really conventional. Yeah. So we tried that approach against Limerick and we were 1-4 to a point down, I'd say, after 8 minutes. And Owen Murphy, great selector with us, said to me, Derek, change to Cork shape. We have a shape called Cork. We bring out the two corner forwards. And I stubbornly just kind of said, no, we'll stick with this now, you know. So, you know, I look back on things of that, they're almost cringe moments for me, you know, looking back on that inability. That's why I have great admiration for Davey Fitz, you know, in terms of when he sticks, you know, and right, he's able to change mid-game, but if he feels it's the right way, regardless of how the previous week went, he'll just go at what's right, you know, and I think that's, I learned from that.
And if Owen Murphy had that conversation with you on the Tuesday, or maybe he did, or Dan Shanahan, or some of the senior players, were you just so bullheaded after
I
the
was
victory,
bullheaded after the draw against a draw against Tipperary and a performance, and what surrounded us that week in Waterford was complete positivity from everywhere. We're back. We're playing the DNA. That's the way Waterford should play. It was every, you know, and you know this kind of, and the irony of it is, I was in that situation so many times over the 5 years that I allowed myself. And then what did Limerick do? They did exactly what we do. They brought out their two corner forwards, their half forward, and came out in the middle of the field. Five flooded the middle of the field, had the numbers everywhere, runners from everywhere, and they actually put what I would consider not our game plan, but a game plan that has Davey Fitz written all over it, has Kinnerk written all over on us, you know. And that's something I think I wouldn't like to become a reactive team as opposed to a kind of proactive team. I learned that.
And what were you like going home on the bus that evening then?
I wasn't in a good place. And the only thing that was dominating my thoughts at that stage was the Cork match was next week. We had little or no defensive cover for us. We lost Shane Fives that day, so we were down five of the six backs to play in the All-Ireland. And
it's done.
It's done. And decision had to be made around my own future. Yeah. And I was kind of saying, will I provide certainty next Monday, which I did, or will I steady myself and give it a couple of months to dissipate? But if I leave that happen, I'll end up going back again, you know? Which is, you know, so I kind of, that week, I just spent the week kind of organising things around resignation, which is a bit selfish too.
Did it make it more difficult to make that decision because you'd made this, I don't want to say fatal error of judgment in how you went into it tactically, but you're leaving it not on the terms you would have wanted, even regardless of result, even in your impact on the team.
Yeah, and your own mindset. And you're probably leaving the guys with a certain amount of ambiguity or doubt in terms of how you went about it. Like, you almost kind of, I couldn't feel it, but the sense that the players were saying, Derek shouldn't have doubted himself there. You know, that type of thing. So the irony of it is we went back to the two extra corner forwards in the Cork game. Didn't win the game, but performed really well.
Yeah, you seem like the type of character who does analyse himself and his decisions. Like, have you looked back on that week between the Tipperary game and the Limerick game and everything that happened and why you went with things?
Yeah, down to
like with all your experience in five years building up, that still happened.
And the only thing I'd say is there's probably a reason for everything that I've done, which doesn't give me a justification, but in the run-up to the 2017 first round of Munster Championship, we analysed Nash's puckouts to death. We went out in the match, we underperformed. We got a run to the All-Ireland semi-final. Again, we came around to Nash. And we completely kind of concentrated. We did it very simply. We said, right, if the two are lining up, we'll leave Damien Callaghan have it, or we leave, I can't remember who was in the full-back with Cork at the time, we'll leave Chris Joyce have it at right half-back, and we'll occupy the other five spots. And that was the simplicity of approach. We did nothing on Nicky Quaid's puckouts ahead of the Limerick game. So here was, we knew the information, and it was based on, we're concentrating too much on the opposition, you know. So getting the information to the guys and how we're going to go about it, I would question that as well, and my approach in that as well. So I wasn't as detail orientated as I should have been ahead of the Limerick game. I thought the flow of the Tipperary game would flow into the following week, when the reality was Austin was injured, Michael Walsh the Brick was playing wing back and he played wing forward the previous week. We were papering cracks. And look,
we're almost a year on. Does it still bug you?
Oh, it does, yeah. Oh, God, it does. It does. And in fairness to Pádraig, Fanning and the guys in the league final, I see they blocked down the channels for the Nicky Quaid's pockets in the game, giving it to the cornerback. And there's another issue in that as well. So that's a debate for in itself. But it bothers me. Yeah, it bothers me. Of course it bothers you. That's the reality of sport, which you move on to.
And I guess the reality is that you could have gone with a completely different tack against Limerick that day and Limerick could still have won the game, and you might be sitting here going, if we'd just gone with the momentum from the Tipperary match.
And listen, Nathan, the motivation for us ahead of that match was huge, because that was the weekend after the ghost goal decision. So you come out, you face the media, you're self-effacing, you're kind of not blaming anyone. In the realms of your own dressing room, you're kind of saying, we've suffered a serious injustice here. You're adding the Tadhg the Bourke situation from the DRA, you're adding the Welsh Park situation, and you're in your dressing room, you're trying to unleash absolute anger in your performance, and we underperformed. So I got a bit of stick in water over not coming out and admonishing the referee in the cauldron of our own dressing room. We were talking about it in terms of trying to motivate ourselves. But listen, Limerick blew us away, and sometimes you meet a storm and there's nothing you can do with it.
How good are you at coaching from the sideline of reading a game as the game is going on in a Munster Championship, tight ground, intense crowd behind you? Would you have been backed yourself or would you have trusted your lieutenants beside you to keep more of a clinical eye on it? Were you more the G'ing up?
No, I liked, as the years went on, I became from clinical to more animated, if you like, you know. But I think you can be clinically animated. I think Davey, when he's animated, people think that he's not seen it. From a point of view, I know Davey's made the decision to go upstairs this year first half and come down in the second half, which is probably a really good decision, particularly when, you know, you get a view of what's going on. But yeah, I would have hoped that I could see most things during game, mid-game. But I would have felt that during the game, in terms of making a cold decision, there was times where you're just completely isolated away. Again, I would, if I had my time back, the link up that I see that Limerick have, they've one of their selectors over on the far side, Brian Geary, is over there linked up doing the water. Nothing wrong with our water guys, they're the best guys in the world, but even the link up between our physios, between, you know, the whole organisational element of it, that's almost rugby like, if you like. I see Limerick have that, they have it down to a T. And I think they're better at that than anybody else. You know, even watching Kinnerk, if you watch the clip back of Kinnerk coming on, bringing Richie McCarthy on in the All-Ireland final last year, the instructions he's clearly giving him on the way in as he's taking his place in full back with 12 minutes to go in the All-Ireland final. And I just think there's elements of that that we could all improve on as a management team, you know.
Do you want to grab yourself a drink there?
Yeah, sound. Talked out there, sorry.
You're grand. I'll just remind everybody that we are here because of Darkness Into Light, which takes place on May 11th. You can use the hashtag The Power of Hope. It is organised by Pieta House and proudly supported by Electric Ireland since 2013. Just on Paul Kinnerk, like every single hurling person that comes in here raves about his ability as a coach. What is it from what you've seen?
Well, I think there's a couple of key facets of what he does. First of all, I think himself and Davey have worked together for a couple of years, and I don't think that can be overlooked. You know, I think there's elements of what I see Limerick doing that I saw Clare doing under Davey and under Paul Kinnerk. So they have a good relationship. There's obviously a sharing of ideas there. I'm not taking away from Paul Kinnerk's ideas and concepts. I think his ability also to marry or merge fun and enjoyment into what Limerick are doing with how they're playing as well. That was very evident, I think, with Podge and the lads in Clare and Conor McGrath when they were in full flow. Shane O'Donnell and those when they won the All-Ireland with Kinnerk. And it's very evident even with Dowling and those when they talk about, I think there was a quote last year when Dowling hit the penalty and he came out, Kinnerk came out to him and said, look, this is what living is about. So I think he's able to marry the technical side of coaching with the fun and the enjoyable element of kind of just living and playing as well. So he gets that balance right between expression and structure. But I hear the debate about Limerick and people say to me, oh, it's all off the cuff. A lot of it, in my opinion, is off the training ground, which Kinnerk takes credit for, you know, and I think he has to take credit for that element of it. And Kiley even takes more credit, being, I suppose, humble enough to step back, perhaps, and leave him to the training field and yet control things as well himself, you know, and that's what he brings to it. I think he brings that kind of, obviously he's famed for game-based situations and putting guys into situations. And I think, but I think he's more than that. I'd say he's father figure, he's coach, and he's a guy that's completely focused on just getting better all the time and believing in what they're doing. So he seems to be the whole package.
Yeah, I think it's Johnny Murphy when he talks about playing with the Leicester Tigers, talked about one of the key phrases was clarity brings freedom. That for Limerick, that people are looking, thinking that freedom becomes from just something innate, something within, whereas actually it's because they know exactly what the game plan is that they can fall back on when necessary.
And I saw a brilliant piece of rugby analysis a number of years ago. Shane Horgan did it, and he said it's counterintuitive to say it, but he said New Zealand clear that ruck, they come with the ball, and people say that's completely off the cuff. It's off the cuff because it's been simulated, it's been practiced, it's been they know what they're doing. So I think, look, that's a fight I've probably been fighting over the 5 years in terms of the hurling, because, you know, I think I would view myself, I said this to even a number of weeks ago, that as a traditionalist, you know, a traditionalist is someone who loves hurling, believes in hurling, but I think hurling, you can be innovation without, you can be innovative without absolutely losing sight of the principles of hurling, skill, work ethic, honesty, and being authentic in your whole approach. But you can also have the whole thing changed as well as it goes along. And I think Limerick and all the teams have done that over the last number of years.
You mentioned Davey a couple of times there. I get the sense that maybe you think Davey gets a hard time of it.
No, I don't. I just think he's a brilliant hurling mind. I actually think he's a brilliant hurling mind. I think he has the capacity to go into a county, play a certain way, have a strategy, and yet we overlook the whole motivational side of his ability, like in terms of motivating a team, in terms of getting a team on side. I think the easy thing is to talk about the sustainability of what Davey is doing in terms of playing with seven at the back. You know, I think it's the easy thing. I think it's the populist thing to say is, oh, he's playing at seven at the back, why? I think it's harder to kind of say, well, hang on, if you look at the Kilkenny game in Nolan Park last year, they pushed up on the puckers, they came back, you know, and yet they were able to marry that with a performance, albeit beaten on the night. The point, I think it's easier to have the, you know, it's easier to have the debate saying they'll never win anything like that, but it's harder to say why is he doing it. I mean, if Davey was presented with a different job or a different job spec, he might go about it completely different. Even I heard someone saying to him that in the All-Ireland final of 2014 or 2013, whatever year Clare won the All-Ireland there, in the final, they went about it a different way. They went a straight up 15. And yet, if you watch it, you'll see Podge and Conor McGrath come 50 yards from the goal, knowing that they're going to be man-marked. Tony Kelly is going 100 yards from the goal, knowing he's going to be man-marked, which opens up the whole middle of it for Pat Donlan to go down to create the goal for Shane O'Donnell. So those things are all pre-planned, and they're a particular shape where you have one inside, two corner forwards coming out 50 yards from the goal with their men, and the half forward line is part of the midfield, which allows then the six backs to just stay as they are. And people will say, oh God, Clare were great, they were conventional today. Mm. And the reality is they probably played three or four different shapes within that particular game. So, yeah, I think he's a brilliant hurling mind. At times he's very, very animated, but he's very, very passionate about the whole game. And listen, we've had our, not disagreements, but we've had, you know, I met Davey in 2009. He asked me to be a Waterford coach at that time. And I was flattered, and I agreed, I shook hands on it. And then I felt I was too young. A couple of weeks after, I said, Ryan Davies said, I won't get involved. But we'd have a good, not friendship, but we certainly have a healthy respect for how you go about things. You know, if Davey was in a different county, he might go about it completely different.
Yeah. You're going to be doing some punditry over the summer. You've been doing it during the league as well, and I think everyone's enjoyed it. You obviously like sitting down, watching, analysing the games. The conversation, I don't know if you're watching the Champions League coverage this week, where Graeme Souness was getting quite animated about the tactics against passion. He said, if you don't get to the ball first, you have no chance. Simple as. Tactics don't matter a damn. Where do you fall down in the, when it comes to analysing a game, on, particularly in hurling, where we talk about you have to bring the passion and the intensity with going up against the tactical side of it?
Well, I think you do have to bring the intensity. You do have to bring the work ethic. You do have to bring the attitude and the catalyst. The catalyst for a tactical performance has to be your attitude, has to be the pace of how you're doing things, has to be the intensity. And that's my point, that they can coexist. The attitude, the whole idea of, you know, I saw the Roy Keane and Gary Neville debate where they're talking about it's 2 yards, Gary. You know, I'd agree with all those particular principles when you're in a dressing room, but it's about simplifying those things. So we had a phrase in Waterford where we used to say we never work alone. Practically what that means, if the ball goes over your head, you go back and help. So the job of a coach or manager is to be able to simplify all the thought processes in his or her head, and even in terms of language that you use in a dressing room. But yet the players have an understanding of each of their particular roles. So if you take the modern wing forward, if you take Kyle Hayes, he clearly knows, or Tom Morrissey, or Garrod Hegarty, they clearly know they have to offer an offensive threat up one half of the field. But they also know that if they're opposing wing forward, we say, if Dermot Burns is sitting back at 40 yards from the goal and he's not following his man, that number 12 for Galway or for Waterford becomes the property of Garrod Hegarty. And he clearly knows that there's a dual role there. Whereas years ago, you might have a sense of, I'm a forward, I'm here to score, I'm up the field, I'm not coming back the field. I think there's more of an awareness now from everybody that there's dual roles for people. There's nobody saying back in the backs, what are you doing back here? But years ago, if you had a centre forward coming deep down the field, the wing back or the corner back would be roaring at him, what are you doing back here? You know, get up the field. You know, you're kind of telling him to get up the field. So I don't think you have that element of, there's more of an understanding. So as soon as this point in terms of tactics versus passion, I think they can coexist, and I think they have to in the modern game, and that's, I stand over that. I think it's a huge part of it. Now, what you'll get is the winning teams will come out and say, we have a very simple approach. In media terms, they'll say, we have a simple approach, we just work together. And working together, in terms of a layman's terms, is correct, but it's, I'd imagine, look, you only have to look at the Limerick dressing room in the day of the All-Ireland, the posters up, the target-based stuff that they had in their dressing room. Every inter-county dressing room is the same as that. And 15-on-15 is the most overused phrase outside an inter-county dressing, because it's the most underused inside an inter-county dressing.
Really?
That's. Do you see man-on-man battles? 100%. John Conlon, Dahi Burke last year, Conor Gleeson, and whoever he'll pick up this year for Richie Hogan over the years. Do you see lots of man-on-man battles? Of course you do. But I think you see them in the midst of systematic play. Okay, but when you use the word system, it's almost as if you're kind of a robot and you're mechanically minded. My point is that they can absolutely, the fluidity of what Limerick are doing, what Clare have done, what Waterford have tried to do this year and over the years, Cork are doing, they're very similar actually.
So what are you looking to bring with your punditry?
Well, I'm looking to bring an explanation and a depth, I suppose, to what's actually happening, but imparted in a manner that's not complex either. That'll be the challenge, just like management.
How long does it take you to figure out what's going on in the game when you're watching it in a TV studio?
In a TV studio, it's more difficult, but you have a screen and you have the behind the goal angle as well, and you're going from one to the other. So it's difficult to concentrate on one moment, initial moment. You might be calling what's happening and you're looking, jotting down what's happening, but then invariably what I find helpful is if you have a clip in from your own footage at home that links with something, a pattern that a team are doing, you're looking out for something in advance and you've your homework done, that's a good way, I find, of having things ready ahead of when you're on.
I know you've said previously that maybe you regret not taking something of a stronger stance at the time around Walsh Park and Waterford's home games. Obviously, they're getting the couple of home games this year, first up against Clare, then they play Limerick at Walsh Park. How big a factor do you think that'll actually be?
Yeah, I think it'll be huge. I'm living about 20 yards from Welsh Park. My parents are living 20 yards from Welsh Park, so it'll be good. I'll have a good...
Will you go?
I will go. I will. I haven't gone to any Waterford match this year now. Deliberately. Just stayed away from the games this year. I'll go to the championship match, because it's on my doorstep, and I look forward to bringing my own two boys and my wife will go up to it. The four of us will go up to it and we'll enjoy it. The emotion that's gone into the decision around Welsh Park, I think, will present itself in a really, really serious Waterford performance. There's too much gone into the decision. You know, whether Newbridge or Noor acted as a catalyst, whether it was whatever happened last year in terms of, Welsh Park not being available. But I think there'll be so much emotion attached to it. I really think there'll be a coming together of the team and the crowd, and I think it'll be very, 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 very special environment. And I can't see Waterford losing any of their two home games.
So what would you expect Pádraig Fanning to do? Or maybe it's an unfair question to second guess him. What would you do in this situation if you were still in charge this year and all that emotion was surrounding the game at Walsh Park with everything that happened last year? Would you just go with that emotion and let it take you as far as it can?
Yeah, and look, I was interested, knowing the group of players, I read Noel Connors' interview last week. Noel said, look, I'll be just doing the simple things well, like I've always done. And that will be Noel. If you take the likes of Gleeson Austin, who thrives when he's emotionally high, when he's angry, when he's flowing, that's when he thrives. I think it'll be a different approach depending on the players. I think, depending on the individual players, if you like, I think a team that trains in their own environment for 5 or 6 weeks in advance of a championship match will be ready come the championship match, because there's just so much. So would I leave the emotion take over? I wouldn't, but I'd leave some of them right along in that emotion if it meant I was going to get the best out of those guys. And there's 5 or 6 leaders within that group that will love the occasion that it's going to be.
Knowing that on Austin Gleeson, was that always a challenge to get him angry, get him energised?
Sometimes, yeah, because he's a young man. He's a young man who had a lot put at his doorstep at a young age. You know, 2016, Young Hurler of the Year, Senior Hurler of the Year. And then he listens to a winter of people saying, how will he cope with the Hurler of the Year? And then sometimes, subconsciously, it can become ingrained in your mindset. You know, and he had a brilliant 2017, which he often, himself, he's harsh on himself. I text him after one of the matches this year. Clare, he flew against Clare in the league this year. And I just text him saying, great to see you going so well. He said, I'm not going to leave this year. Text me back, said, look, I'm not going to leave this year going without making an impact on the year. And So in terms of getting him up for it, I think there'll be no. He's had to live with an awful lot of expectation, and I think he's had the dip year, and now he's ready to go. Like, and that's why I give Waterford a great chance overall, because, you know, the tangent or the graph was fairly steady up to last year, and now I expect them to come almost not under the radar because they've been in the league final, but certainly with a push, you know.
Are you texting many of the lads?
Not really. I was saying this earlier on. No, not really, because I text Austin after that game against Clare, because I was delighted for him personally. Before the league final, I text Tig and I get on very well with the Mahonies and a few more of Noel and those, and Kevin. I'd see Kevin in school, like, obviously, and but other than that, I've made a kind of conscious decision that, you know, I find sometimes if you're hanging around texting him all the time that you become part of the... Not that you're having a great relationship, but, you know, I don't want to be kind of hanging around that type of scenario, if you like. Not that I haven't, as I said, a great relationship more, so it's better for them, you know.
I'm just laughing because Oisin Langan, who brought you in here, of course, who used to work with Off the Ball, but now moved to PR, never stops texting us and WhatsApping us. Just won't leave. Just won't leave. It's a bit awkward, Oisin. You could learn a thing or two here. Here, to wrap up, we better get some predictions. Like, if you're talking about Waterford winning their two home games and beating Limerick at Walsh Park, like, the tightness of the Munster Championship means if Limerick lose a game, like, it's, well, we know how special the whole summer is going to be. Who do you think is going to come out of Munster? Probably don't need to look at it.
Yeah, well, I'd base predictions on I won't say preparation or planning, but Waterford have very good preparation. And I think, you know, they were weak in Portugal last week, trained hard. They're at it the last 3 weeks. The Wednesday after the club scenario, they were back in. You know, the hurlers are back in. Obviously, the footballers had another 2 weeks. So they've had a good run into it, 5 or 6 weeks of preparation. I think Waterford will come through. They'll be one of the three. I think there's a kick in Tipperary. I don't really know. I'm only basing it on the forward line of Bonner Maher, Jason Ford, Jamie Callan, Bubbles, John McGrath, Noel McGrath, Dan McCormick coming back. And I'd say they'll have a more strategic approach than they've had other years. Just, you know, maybe a bit more, few more bodies in the middle of the field. So I fancy Tip to come through. And I fancy Limerick to come through. So that would, at this stage, I'm cheeky enough or impudent enough to say that Cork and Clare won't come through. And the reason I'm saying it is I think Clare remind me of ourselves in 2017, in that the winter this year, all I heard was Clare were that close, Shanahar, goal, blah, blah, blah. I think David Reedy is a significant loss to Clare. It hasn't been muted much. I think he's a good player. Conor McGrath, and I see Ian Galvin is out as well. So I think Clare might make it on the back of expectation, kind of, you know, nearly kind of just having their dip year. I think it might come. And it's very ironic that I'm actually mentioning that Cork mightn't get there, because if Shamie Harnedy takes another yard around Nicky Quaid, they're in the All-Ireland Final, and they're possibly winning the All-Ireland Final. But I just think they finished up their club scenario only last Sunday week, and so they have 2.5 weeks preparation for the game, as opposed to Tipperary, who have had a 5 or 6 week run in. Waterford have had 5 or 6 week run in. And Cork's forward line is probably the best forward line out there. If you have Cadigan, Horgan, Lahan, who am I missing? I'm missing up someone very, very obviously. Shane Kingston, Luke Mead, Shamie Harnedy, and Daniel Carney. If you have that forward line, it's very, very potent. But I just have a feeling, given the fixture list, you have Tip and Cork in the first game, and then Cork have to go to Limerick in the second game. So if Tip were to win that, I think Limerick might beat Cork in the next match, which means the Cork Waterford game is a knockout game, possibly for both teams. Yeah. So I think what will happen this year is, I think there will be someone go out on head-to-head this year, and there'll be someone go out on even 4 points. Might, you know, 4 points might be the most the winning team has, and it might be 4-4-2. So that's as good a prediction.
You've
as
thought
I can
about
give.
It anyway.
I have. Jeez, I have, because I've gone through, you know, each in my own head. I'm kind of saying what might happen, but it's just you have to put the caveat in for anyone predicting that. I think there'll be egg on everyone's face, every pundit, you know, or every player, or every passionate fan. You know, there'll be egg on everyone's face.
All right, Derek, great stuff. You've been very good with your time. As always, Derek's here, having teamed up with Electric Ireland and Pieta House to encourage people to experience the power of hope by registering for this year's Darkness Into Light event. It takes place 11th of May. Check out darknessintolight.ie.
The Saturday panel on Off the Ball.